Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a video and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Today, I'm very privileged to welcome a very, very senior and accomplished professional manager from Singapore, Amit Mohta. Amit, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Amit is works for Unilever Singapore. He leads the procurement of over US $12 billion worth of goods and services. So Amit, tell me, what would you say are three key milestones in your life or your career?
Well, milestones typically are in a straight line. Mine has not been, so I would call it pivotal moments.
Okay.
So for me, three pivotal moments. First is, my father passed away when I was 11, and I'm sure some of your listeners may have had similar such start. That moment was critical because that pivoted me into focus on education being the only way out of probably a life, an uneventful life thereafter. So that was one very, very big moment, which lasted for about 10 odd years, which I would say education focused. Within which the second piece I would say is when I made a decision to move out of Calcutta, which was my home city, to Delhi. And you might remember back in 1992-93, there were not so many people who would venture out. The reason I did that, I wanted to expose myself to the real world and stay alone and independent, which I thought in hindsight was very useful. It opened my mind and it paved the way for my education at IIM and then future career. The third thing, Ashutosh, was at a certain stage of my career, about 8 or 9 years into the company, I calculated about where the world is going and where I should pivot my career, and I chose to move to procurement. And that was very, very fruitful for me, and I thought that was also pivotal for myself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I read about you initially, I said, you know, for someone as well qualified as you to start to take a conscious decision so many years ago in supply chain was very, very creditable, because supply chain has become fashionable in the last 3-4 years.
That's correct.
Traditionally, I always remember when I was growing up, and I'm much older, it was always the purchase manager, you know, and now it's become a very, very big science.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, let's now talk about Unilever. Tell me about your role. I mean, $12 billion is a huge amount of procurement.
Yeah. So just to set the context, in India, we have Hindustan Unilever, which is a prized asset within the Unilever world. Globally, Unilever is about a 51 billion euro company. We have operations pretty much in most of the world. And we are fortunate that every day, a large number of consumers use our products, and it's part of our daily lives. Now, within that, when you run such a large corporation of 51 billion euro, a lot goes into making the products and services which consumers like us use, right? So that amounts to about 35 billion euros. Asia for us is circa 1/3 of the total footprint. Mm-hmm. And Asia for us starts from Japan in the east and Pakistan in west and New Zealand in south. So that's the geography which I am responsible for. The role basically is to ensure that all the raw pack materials and all the contract manufacturers which we purchase from and the services, whether it is agencies, professional services, etc., everything we procure following all our policies, be competitive and always remain true to the purpose why we exist, which for Unilever is making sustainable living commonplace. And procurement has a massive role to play of where we source from, what we source, and how it impacts consumers. So that's what essentially we do in procurement. My own role, I would say in today's time, half of the role is about people, because I'm fortunate to have a very large team spread out of all different cultures and nationalities. So working with them and leading them is a privilege. And that consumes about half the time, right from recruitment to nurture to coach. And the other half goes into business engagement and supplier engagements, which, as you can imagine, in a large multinational is quite a big, intense job. Mm. So that's the broad interplay.
Absolutely fascinating. And for someone who has seen the evolution of the supply chain, for our viewers and listeners, tell me, how has it evolved from purchase to procurement to supply chain?
Very interesting. you know, I come from a business family background. So somehow commercial was my second nature. So when I first joined the Hindustan Lever from the campus, I always thought this is a large multinational. One thing we would do is combine our resources and, you know, get scale. As I entered the corporate world, and those were early days from 1998 to 2005, I saw a lot of internal processes, operation. I was very privileged to get a lot of great experiences with great leaders. One question which I always asked is, I don't know outside of India what happens and how do they run their operations. So I chose to do a go to one of my line leaders and say, I want a job in procurement, because that was the only vertical under commercial which I hadn't done. So he said, oh, I have a job for you in India for local business. I said, but that's not what I want to do for. So I went out of the room. So when I, as I was leaving, he called me. He said, okay, come, wait, why don't you go to X and take over that particular role? Which was very interesting, because that was the first time I started to understand there was somebody who was looking at Asia as a whole to buy chemicals. And the India, Hindustan Lever is a very professional organization, forever always been, and we had the best of talent. So we were very good at procurement and purchasing even then. However, and there was a feeling that, you know, what we were doing was really good. And as I stepped on my first journey outside India to Thailand to buy some chemicals for that market, and I, on my return journey, I was comparing the price for the same material in India versus in Thailand. I thought I was making a mistake. The mistake being the price in Thailand was much cheaper than in India. Even if I had paid the freight and imported, it would be still better off. And that opened my eyes of difference between a local purchase and an international procurement or sourcing organizations. That's how the journey began, and I started to see. The second element, Ashutosh, I would add is the world started to globalize somewhere around this 2005 era, if you remember. And that had huge implications for us in business. So, and you worked in international operations, you can see the cross-border flow. And that was a second pivot. The third was in 2008 when the world collapsed with GFC. And most of the organizations for the very first time started to realize the impact on P&L of the volatility of crude oil and many other commodities. And profit was wiped up because there was no process in many, many companies. So that was the ultimate evolution of that procurement, which controls about 2/3 of P&L for any company, is crucial for success.
Amazing. So tell me, you know, when you look at companies like Unilever, 51 billion euros revenues, etc., why is centralized procurement so important? And does it not become inefficient with a small group of people controlling such large procurement?
Yeah, I would, you know, there is a common perception, centralized, globalized, these are all interchangeable words. In my experience, they are not. We are not centralized purchasing by any means, yeah, or procurement. What we are is a global function, and we have our teams spread out across the globe. Why is it that this makes sense? And this makes sense even when world was getting full globalized, then we had a period when, you know, people started to move back to nationalistic boundaries. Yeah. And then again, now we will probably move into a new era. First is, which is obvious, buy more and buy at scale. It gives you advantage and we should do it, obvious. However, within that, there are complexities and inefficiencies of the same shampoo being made with different formulations at a certain point of time, even having ingredients which are similar but not same. So you don't get scale. So huge efficiencies of scale harmonization, which one could unleash. But equally, the one which are less spoken about, Ashutosh, is scale of skill. You would, I would argue that to find great talent across the world is not that easy for a function like procurement. So if you have a larger pool of people in some markets and you could export them into other markets, you can raise the overall bar for performance. Right. And then there is the scale of information. It is easier said than done. You know, you really need a lot of technical understanding of the subject in order to drive value.
Right. Very interesting. So, you know, when I was, again, growing up, we used to constantly hear this term just in time, which came from the Japanese. And now, of course, you know, just in time is all over the world. How is technology changing procurement?
Yeah, So technology has always played a massive role, and evolution has been first from all the ERP systems, if you start from back in 2000s, and then onwards further. And planning systems have typically hogged the limelight. If you see MFG Pro, SAP, Edexa, and so on and so forth, and they have really added value. In the world of procurement, currently, we have been embarking on a large-scale digital transformation. Mm-hmm. And within that, there are two big elements. One is the efficiency of our processes, mm-hmm. and second is about effectiveness of what we do. Mm-hmm. Efficiency is all about, you know, I'm sure we all have experiences about purchasing being very laborious, manual, paper-driven kind of function. Yeah. How do we digitize it to gain scale and speed? The second is about effectiveness. There is immense amount of data today, whether it's in the external landscape or internally. How do we mine it to get better insights, better quality of suppliers to buy from and lead for the change? Massive value. And I would humbly say that we are only at the beginning of this mega power called computational mining. And more to come in this space. So technology on that is given. The second thing may be about using something about satellite imagery, etc. So today, companies like ours, which have huge imprint on sustainable sourcing, how do you find whether your suppliers are following the sustainable practices? So you can do a lot of audits, which we do. But apart from that, you use a lot more technology to understand the change, monitor the impact, and then engage with a lot of insight with the suppliers to drive the change towards, let's say, more sustainable farming practice, among many other things.
You know, in the region that you just defined right at the beginning of our conversation, you must be covering 30, 40 countries, if not more. Procurement, while you are, you know, handling it out from a large team in Singapore, the actual supply has to go to each country where your factories are sitting. How do you mitigate risk procurement or delays?
Yeah, and risk is a big subject. Yeah, what I do is first I always define risk as two: one is systemic risk, and one is the non-systemic risk. Mm-hmm. Systemic risk is when everybody gets impacted in the world. So COVID is a classic case; it's a systemic risk. Correct. You couldn't have planned too much because you didn't know these kind of events. So, and that's the way we would manage systemic risk is to diversify sourcing origins, etc. When it comes to non-systemic, which is a particular supplier did not deliver on time, so typically the inventory is our first safeguard, obviously, like any other company. But we keep looking at a tiered down approach of why the supplier could not deliver, what could have gone wrong in their sourcing base, etc., and work towards providing lot more resilience into that. The second thing is agility. It is, in today's time, even more so, it is very difficult to forecast demand. Demand is changing every now and then. So you need alternate sources pretty much as part of the design. Some which may be at a little bit higher cost, but are more flexible, and some which are very scale driven and therefore could be a bit more rigid. Mm-hmm. So we keep a balance between both of those as part of our design itself. Okay. The last thing I would say is you can put as many processes as those. At the end, it is about relationships and the brand which the company carries. So can we learn to behave and honor our words so we become the customer of choice for our suppliers and we be on the first of the queue whenever there is a crisis?
Very interesting. And, you know, another question related to supply chain. Traditionally, supply chain was always inwards into the company. But then there is a huge supply chain that is from the factories out into the marketplace also. How do you synergize two completely different set of customers and a completely different set of needs?
Yeah, so inbound and outbound logistics is what you're talking about. And these are two different in some aspects, because one is about managing warehouse, which is the outbound warehousing, a certain schedule of deliveries and working with the customer side of things. That I would say is largely localized operations for our kind of setup. Of course, there are some international moves also, but largely localized. When you look at upstream, which is on procurement side of things, the logistics is a mix of ocean freight, road freight, customs, the whole works. the trace and track becomes extremely important because the lead times are much longer. So therefore, you need a lot more tools about in a local operation within about 24 hours, you can reach your products to the customer. Tracing and tracking is not that important as it is for the upstream. So there are some differences like that. What we also do is there are some synergies of, you know, providing virtual control towers to monitor these operations, whether it is upstream or downstream. When you are handling this, you can get a lot more intelligence centrally at a control tower level and create scale synergy about it. Second thing I would say is the partners who work on upstream and downstream, sometimes they are the same companies. So let's take the case of DHL. So DHL would have a great downstream operation, but they are equally present in many parts like air freight. They are quite big. So we can leverage relationship with same supplier base in different markets for up and downstream.
Interesting. And, you know, over the last 8-10 years, the entire digital platforms that have come into supply chain have started to have an impact. What are the e-commerce platforms doing to supply chains?
So I'll talk first about procurement. So marketplace as a concept in procurement is still gathering momentum, still at an early stage. So there are some marketplaces, especially in China, which start to provide commodity materials pretty much like you and I would buy on Amazon some of our personal needs. So you can buy caustic soda today on 1688.com. And that trend, I believe, will gather a lot more momentum wherever product differentiation is rather limited and it is a very commoditized specification. That is the way to go. It is the most lean way of buying commodities. But on the other side, there are very specialized materials where that may not be the most suitable and the number of suppliers providing that may not be enough also. So therefore, there is some degree possible, but it won't ever be 100% on a marketplace phenomena. On the downstream, there is a lot happening. I'm sure in India as well as outside India, the direct to consumer is becoming a massive trend. Again, I use China as an example because that market is so far ahead of rest of the world that we could learn from there of how to adapt to how to serve a consumer and yet make a reasonable margin because it's quite costly. The whole old paradigm was you gain scale on distribution. That paradigm is now changed with e-commerce and internet. To go direct to consumers. Well, so not happening in that space.
I agree. It's very well said. So let me move to another part of our common conversation. For someone who has, you know, been running such large businesses and in an organization as valued as Unilever, what are some of the core values you believe in?
My core value is first is integrity and trust. When you, especially as you get more senior, you are on your role because somebody is trusting you very high on integrity to carry on large operations. And this is at a very, very core level. And this, when done effectively and consistently, you develop a lot more better relationships. So that's the very core value for me personally. I value that more than anything else. The second thing I would say is a can-do spirit. I always start by saying, how can we do it rather than why it can't be done and try to find some small leeway to do it. And last is learning all the time. And, you know, recently I've been learning a lot about diversity and inclusion. For me, this is very, very core. In India, I think I grew up in India. Was fortunate because there were so many people from so many regions. So we didn't understand the power of diversity until you go out to a market where there's a homogeneity. Yes. So, but when you work with a variety of people, the additive capabilities are immense versus working with a similar type of people. And so I start to value the diversity and inclusion enormously.
Wonderful. One more question before I move to a few questions for you personally. For someone who runs such large teams, what would you say is your leadership style?
Yeah, this is a question which I also keep reading a lot about. By no means would I say that I have reached the end game. One thing I've realized is this leadership style is all about situation and the context in which you operate. When there is a crisis, let's say when COVID first struck us, at that time, it was all about directive. Yeah, you really need to get the job done. There is not too much thinking and you want just speed at that moment. However, there are times when it's all about Are you able to read what's going on in the person's life, your colleague's life, and come from that angle and add more value to that person? Mm-hmm. By and large, however, I see myself as a coaching leader, somebody who listens first and tries to understand where it is going and then add experience / insight to the person's thinking. And I don't think I provide the answer. I always lead into a direction, and then I always enjoy seeing the person lead into that end game themselves.
Wonderful. So Amit, I'm going to now move to the last segment of our conversation. There are some questions for you personally. For someone, as you yourself said, moved from Calcutta to Delhi, went to the top, one of the top business schools, joined Hindustan Lever, moved to Bangkok, overseas, Singapore, running such a large business. From where you are today, as you look back at life and as you look ahead at the all the amazing things that will happen to you, what does success mean to Amit?
Yeah. Look, I never ever imagined in my life when I was 11 years old, when my father passed away, that I would be anywhere close to where I am. So I've been extremely grateful of many things which have happened in my life. Luck does have a part. However, I do believe the grit and discipline plays a massive role. So success for me is a blend of these five things, which I heard on a podcast some time back. You need a balance between many things. So there is the health space, which is vital. There's a mental space, which is vital, emotional, and then about financial piece. So you need to merge all of these and reach a some sort of balance. It is often I find myself on imbalance on one or the two of them, and then I recalibrate myself. So if I can manage this on a longer term basis, I think I would be successful in my own eyes.
That's one of the finest descriptions I've heard on success, on calibration of multiple formats, you know. So thank you. My next question, Amit, following from success, is who or what inspires you?
Well, I do get a lot of inspiration from books which I read and videos or podcasts which I embrace. As a person, I think I have deeply been inspired by my mother. For a couple of things which I have seen now over my entire age, of how somebody with in a situation where she was widowed at a very early age, and from moving on from there with not much education and not many resources at her disposal, by two things, by faith and by discipline and rigorous hard work. These are the two things which I have seen. And somehow, you know, you get inspired by this. Initially, it is a drag, but then it becomes inspiration because that shows you the way and success quite often. And I'm privileged about having such parenting. And there are many times in life when many different small things happen when you get get answers from how would my mother be thinking on this particular issue, and then you move on. So, yeah, I'm really inspired by her as a person.
Fabulous. So I'm going to ask you two more questions now. My next question is on failure. And I've often said that parents in South Asia, India, South Asia, maybe most of Asia, don't teach children it's okay to fail. You know, it's always come first, go to the head of the line, etc., etc. Yet we fail. My question to you is, what have been some of your learnings from some of your mistakes?
Yeah, of course, we all fail. So many times every day, the more you try, the more you fail is the dictum. One incident which happened several years ago is, you know, you are asked in multinational saying, oh, this is the job we have thought about you. What do you think? As a early career manager, I did not even have the ability to say no. I think that's another aspect of our South Asian upbringing. We respect hierarchy and we say yes far too often without meaning anything. And I said yes to a role where I had two bosses. I did not know anything about either of the bosses or the job, but I said, yeah, if somebody has said, it must be right. And it was a big disaster for me personally. I was under so much stress trying to balance one versus the other. And I thought it was a mistake. From there, I started to ask myself, what would happen if I said no? Because the first fear everybody has, oh, they will fire me, etc. But at the end, as you grow in confidence, you realize it's not so extreme ever. It is about you articulating your position much more sharply, clear for the better good at the end of the day. So, yeah, not able to say no at many times has been a drag. And I think I've learned over years, that's one big mistake.
Fantastic. And my last question to you now is, for the thousands of people who will listen to all your words of wisdom and all your advice, what would your advice be to a young individual who's starting off on her or his journey in the corporate world?
Yeah, of course. So when I started, there were no startups. So it was all about education and a career. But today's youngsters are very privileged to have many options. Now, within that, some principles I would like to share is, first is, broaden your horizons early stage of your career, because later you may not get that many opportunities. So broaden it as much as possible. Stretch yourself. Fail, no problem, because you will get chance again. And after about this, I think 10 years is a good mark. After 10 years, 11 years, you should figure out where your sweet spot is.
Right.
All of us have strengths. And then go into it with vigor and specialize. Because everyone has some strengths. Play on your strengths and then make the biggest mark. Two things, remember, your brand has huge value. What people say about you when you're not in the room. Never ever sacrifice your brand. The second thing, if you have aspiration to grow in your career, always remember it is going to be disproportionately about people. How you deal with people is going to make or break your career.
Amazing. I mean, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. I loved your comments about your leadership style being one of a coaching leader. I think that was amazing. You know, I loved what you just said about, you know, you are what you are when people speak about you when you're not in the room. I think that's such a powerful statement to make. And, you know, I'm amazed at how much clarity you have had about your career and how, you know, for the first 10, 11 years of your life, you actually focused only on education. It's been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ashutosh. It's a privilege to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.